Welcome to the Independence by Design podcast, where we discuss what it means to be a business owner and ways to get unstuck from the day-to-day so we can design a business that gives us a life of independence. Welcome to the show. My name is Ryan Tansom, your host. I'm very excited to have you here. This is episode 400, and this is the Independence by Design podcast. And what I'm going to be doing here is breaking down what Independence by Design is. And I'm going to do it succinctly because I've been doing a lot of workshops, a lot of speaking over the last 10 years, and this has been many iterations. And in earlier this year in 2024, I spun out onto my own to focus specifically on owner education and coaching. And so what I wanted to do in this episode is just walk everybody through my journey to get here. And it not only includes the family business that we grew and sold, but then over the last 10 years, the three different ventures that I've been in, the multiple brandings of the podcast. And as you can see, this is episode 400. However, I've got all the previous podcasts that my ex-partners were willing to let me keep. And I've got those on my YouTube channel. But what I want to do now going forward is be very succinct and deliberate about what I'm going to be putting on this podcast, making sure that everybody understands the full context of, like, if I'm interviewing someone, how does it fit into the ownership framework, and how does it help you, the owner operator, create sustainable cash flow, independence over your time and equity in your company so you can have choices? And so what I'm going to do in this episode is going to be breaking down my journey to get here. So if you're familiar with my journey, you can skip ahead. If you're not, I'm going to break down my journey. I'm then going to break down what I've learned over the course of the last 10 to 15 years, and then how that led to the Independence by Design ownership framework. And then I'm going to break down the three steps of the Independence by Design ownership framework. So if you want to skip ahead to any of those different chapters, it's in the show notes. And then I've also got a screen share that I'm going to be pulling up right now. So if you're listening in, I think it'll be sufficient because I'm just going to be talking through and telling stories. But also, if you wanted to check out any of the images and the slides and all that stuff, it's all on YouTube. And again, you can jump ahead depending on what level of awareness and understanding that you've got about me and my journey. So the Independence by Design owner's framework is, the whole point about it is getting unstuck. Unstuck is this word that I kept hearing people saying because they're stuck in their business, and it's not stuck about revenue growth. And I'm going to be talking about the difference between an ownership framework, which is what I'm talking about here, versus the operator framework. And so most people listening in, or a lot of the people that I've been talking to for years, they're an owner operator. So there's tons of operating systems like EOS, scaling up, OKRs. How do you grow your business? How do you have good KPIs, good accountability? But I realized there was no ownership framework. And I stumbled across that and really refined this over the last 6 months as I've been focusing on that. And so I'm going to be talking about how I got there and what this is, and then that'll lay the groundwork for all of the future podcast episodes, as well as all the training that I do for the ownership coaching. So a little bit about me. I had a family business turnaround, an eight-figure exit 10 years ago in July of 2014. I have been a podcast host for, oh my gosh, it's been like 7 years or so, about 400 episodes in, 500 plus thousand downloads. The data kind of sucks, but it's been it's at least above that between YouTube, between Spotify, iTunes, et cetera. All of the material that I've been working on for over a decade has led to this Independence by Design. And I've had at least 1,500 owner operators go through the boot camps or the virtual training or the Vistage workshops or the conference keynotes that I've done. And I've had three businesses over the last 10 years that were some successful, some not so successful. And then I've had a bunch of certifications that I've done over the last 10 years, none of which are even close to as important as Eating Glass and running and starting companies. But I'll be talking a little bit about those and how that led me to better insights into what we're talking about today. So where did all this journey start? Well, it started when I read this book, Finish Big by Bo Burlingham, and it was after we sold the business, and I'll be talking about that. But I found out that, you know, from reading his book, that 75% of owners were unhappy 12 months after they sold their company, regardless of how much money they made. And why I thought this was so important is because Bo is the editor of Inc. magazine for 7 years. He's been on the podcast a couple times. I actually spoke at the Small Giants, his conference, as a keynote last year, personal highlight of mine. And why this is so important is because he was researching what it meant to exit, even though we're going to really be talking about, this is not about exiting. It's about creating independence through cash flow and equity growth and understanding this ownership framework that I'm talking about. And I'm going to talk about why the word exit is so terrifying to so many people. But what Bo realized is that there was all this money or all this research around how to grow and, you know, raise money on VC. A lot of the Inc. stuff is about raising money, product pricing fit, and scale, scale, scale. But like, what does it mean to grow and exit and look on the other side as an owner operator. And he realized that 3 out of 4 people were unhappy, no matter how much money they made. And I can tell you what, after 400 episodes in the podcast, that is absolutely true. And a lot of the people he was interviewing are owner operators. And so I'm going to talk about how I learned this from my personal journey with the family business, and then how I've been trying to figure out how to avoid this over the last 10 years and now what I've done about it. When I say my story, my entrepreneurial journey started with my father, Corey, and he was, barely graduated White Bear Lake High School, 90 days in Mankato State, and he ended up just selling stuff from calling cards to credit card machines, and he stumbled across technology, in quotes, copiers back in the early 90s. And he ended up starting our family business after we got transferred to Arizona and we moved back, and he mortgaged our house and bought a bunch of inventory of copiers. So I got a semi-truck full of copiers here where it was like a few $100,000, found out it was a bunch of bad inventory, and he had no plan B. He always told my mom and us that we'd have a pool, but we just weren't sure whether it was going to be at the apartment building that we were renting from or our house. We ended up having one at our house. But what happened was I literally loved business because I would, I'd wait for him after he'd get done with work and it'd be 9 o'clock. And I remember him scaling from 0 employees up to 115. But I remember when he didn't have the Canon licensing and he'd come home and he'd tell me how he got the Canon licensing and then what would be happening at the business. I was doing meter reads, which was calling people to bill them for the additional copies that they had, to moving the multiple buildings because he scaled up to 3 locations in the Twin Cities, Twin Cities, St. Cloud, and Duluth. And we were just, it was so fun to watch. I was doing internships there my whole life. I ended up selling copiers, drowned in a suit at the age of 19 with my friend James Rogers back in the day. And then even in high school or in college, doing internships, swore on my grave I'd never go work for him. But I was watching him scale this business. So he hit $21 million in revenue, 115 employees, fastest 50, Inc. 5,000, got all the awards. And him and I have got a lot of good conversations around what is it they're all measuring? And we got all these awards and I swore my grave I'd never go work for him. However, I got this picture up here of me and him. And when I graduated St. John's in 2009, I decided to go work for him because in 2009, the world was a dumpster fire and all my smart friends didn't have any job offerings. And as a sales guy, I was willing to go work for $1,000 or $1,500 a month. So I got convinced to sell solutions, which effectively was just managed print services, which is effectively copiers. I got suckered into that in 2009. And, what happened was really quickly, as an owner's kid, you have two choices: be the entitled prick everybody thinks you're going to be, or you work twice as hard to get half the credit. And I did the latter part. But the cool part I think about that was in sales, you have no choice but to put up the numbers because everyone can see how well you're doing. So, I made a lot of money in 2009 and 10 selling copiers. And what happened was my dad ended up bringing me into all the bank and the CPA meetings. I'm forever indebted to him because at 22 years old, I have no idea what the hell is going on. And I'm sitting there in the bank in the CPA meeting. And in 2009, we found out that we were in hard times. And what happened is, and this is Corey's own, my dad's own truth, but he was going through a lot of personal baggage at home. He had going through divorce with my mom. He had a silent partner at that point, and just a lot of personal stuff. And he had been very distant from the company. And at that point, there was a GM running the business, there was a lot of toxicity. There was a lot of just bad players in the business, and there was a lot of just stuff that needed to be changed because he'd been very distant from the company. And there was so much cash flow in the business. So we're sitting there in December of 2009, and I'm sitting there as a young 22-year-old, and I found out that we lost $940,000 on $21 million of revenue. And I remember everything changing that day because we had $240,000 in payroll. We had a $21 million business, but we lost $940,000. And the market in that entire time completely got flipped on its head because all the margins of the equipment were just evaporated. So back in the day, there used to be, I remember when he was selling copiers for 100 and 150% margins, people were wrapping and rolling and refinancing with a scanner. Oh my God, there was so much money in the business back in the day. And then on about a $21 million business, about $7 or $8 million, or maybe a little bit more, was equipment. Well, that big, huge margin got evaporated. Thank God we had $10+ million in bank finance locked in contracts to save us. But what happened was we found out the hard way that our family and the business was running off of cash flow, and like annual cash flow, and not actual equity growth. And what was this company worth? So we're sitting there going, okay, we did $21 million in revenue. We lost $940,000, and we got to hit payroll every other week. And what are we supposed to do here? So we were looking at revenue, optimizing the gross margins. And then at some point there would be cash in the checking account, and that would help us fund the lifestyle that we were growing and that my dad thought he deserved in order to grow the business. But we had a decision that time in December of 2009, which is, what do we do? Do we have a fire sale? And we sell this company for, you know, whatever we thought it could be worth, so that way we could make the whole journey up until that point worth it. And what we didn't necessarily, I mean, we had some ideas of what it would be worth because we had finance contracts. Or do we do what I think a lot of people listening into this episode would do, which is double down, personally guarantee more stuff, and then try and figure out how to save everybody, because we had 100 and some families working for us. It was our entire like livelihood. And the reality was, I wanted it. I mean, at that point, I was working for the business. So it's like, okay, well, what could this be worth for me and for everybody going forward? So that whole experience then led us to, through spit, duct tape, and glue, and you name it, over the next five some years, it was a couple of things. One, never miss the $240,000 payroll. And my God, do I have payroll stories for people. And the next one was, make sure we've got the payables in line so that way the vendors will continue servicing our clients. Trying to optimize inventory. I mean, it was a cash flow game. I mean, it was juggling cash flow, and we were actually financing our receivables. My dad had gotten onto that factoring program back when he was scaling the business so fast, but we never got off it. And then the bank actually had some problems because they had this factoring division, and we'll talk about that in a second. But over the next 5 years, what I ended up doing was, not just me, but like my whole team. And it was like, I mean, we went from this toxic, gross environment to ended up replacing, and I ended up, I think it was close to 50 some people I fired personally by the time I was like 25. We ended up selling two branches for cash, ended up building out the managed print services, the software document management automation division, the managed IT services, putting in a new ERP system, and then, you know, having two ERP systems because we had the two different divisions, and then rebranding. And like, it became a lot of fun. I mean, I think about the team that we had, and it was, I read this book, Zappos Delivering Happiness, and it was honestly that kind of culture. I was having an absolute blast with my team, family and friends and all that stuff. We even won the Minnesota Wild as a full technology provider, and it was so fun. Just fun, you know, architecting the deals, winning the deals, multi-million dollar deals where we were doing managed print services, managed IT services, data hosting, document management, licensing, and all this stuff bundled in on a price per user, bank finance. So we were rocking and rolling at what we were doing, and our team was having a lot of fun. And then the bank called, because the bank that we were working with had a bunch of shit loans from 2008, 9, and whatever. And we were no longer part of their, they didn't want us part of their portfolio anymore. So they wanted to kick out the factoring part of the division. But the problem is they were making, I mean, I think it was close to $700,000 in fees off of us. So they actually couldn't cancel us. So for a few years, it was this complete wrestle and race to who can get healthy enough to cancel each other. And I literally remember my dad sliding, hit the keys over to one of the bankers, said, fine, you collect the receivables. And I'm like, holy shit. And then they just slid it back over. And I'm like, oh my God. And it was, you know, so many things that I learned, but it's all about the leverage and understanding your value. But what, you know, this constant juggling of the payroll, juggling of the turnaround. And we had a great business at this time, but the bank couldn't refinance us because they had sold the SBA loan. And the banker that was the president, now passed, who was really nice, had no control because the FDIC had come in. And I just, like, we had no control, but we had a great business and we had millions of dollars in contracts with good margins. And we couldn't figure out, I mean, at this time, I think we, what I counted, we interviewed 17 different banks trying to refinance our SBA loan. At the end of the day, we needed like a $1.5 million SBA loan and for our working capital. And we needed to refi the building. And I mean, pretty basic stuff, but this is in 2012 where no one wanted to do any lending. And it just so miserable that the banking situation is what was sending these dominoes into effect, because we had done all the hard work to turn the business around. And this entire time, we're sitting in these, sitting in these meetings. We had started to kind of talk about EOS, getting organized. My dad and I both joined Vistage. And so we got people from all angles, from wealth managers to consultants to attorneys to employees to peer groups to investment bankers to bankers, giving us ideas about how to, like, how do we take this business? Do we refinance? Does Ryan buy the company? Can we get, do we hire someone as a president? All these decisions were just swallowing us alive, and we couldn't see through any of them. And then we get done with these meetings or done with, you know, internal conflict with him and I. So many fights. Love him to death. We're best friends. And I like, but like when you're in the trenches like that, it's stressful as shit. And, you know, we get done with all these technical things and we like, you know, advice, and we like, well, we just need to sell more shit. We need to sell more revenue to hopefully have more margin, to hopefully have more cash flow. And so we got so sick and tired of this for a year and a half that we ended up just looking at each other going, and we were sitting at Granite City in Roseville, Minnesota. And he looked at me and goes, I want my money. I don't want to talk about copiers. I got to get out of this. And we had exhausted every single avenue. And I was like, I get it. I mean, like at this point, like there's nothing else we can do. So we pinned up three local competitors. And then over the course of the next few months, we had a few different offers for the business. And of the three offers, one was almost double the value because we picked the biggest suitcase full of money. And the reason we picked that one is because it had the most amount of money, but the other two wanted to keep everybody. But what ended up happening, because we picked the most amount of money, is we ended up on July 1st, 2014, had to go back to the office, call in 90 employees at that time. There was probably 20 people that were salespeople in the field, maybe 20 people that were technicians in the field, call them in for an all company meeting that wasn't planned. I just still get the stomach ache about it. And everybody came in. We had to tell them that we sold to our competitor that we'd been, you know, brutally fighting in the marketplace forever. And only 33 out of the roughly 90 people got their jobs. It was just horrific. I mean, I remember sitting in the cube just thinking about, like, staring at my friends that I went to college with, people that I had hired who came to work for me and for this vision that we were going to create as the all, you know, company technology provider. And we're sitting in this building. And if you're watching this, this is not our building, but emotionally what it felt like, there was just stuff everywhere. My dad and I were sitting in a 26,000 square foot building by ourselves after we sold. And I was like, what the F was that? I mean, I'd sacrificed my, you know, the last 5+ years. And then my dad's 17 years and like all of the family. I mean, it was everything. And what I realized is that our entire life and my entire identity had walked out that front door, and we exchanged it for an 8-figure wire that we also paid a bunch of taxes in. So I'm almost done with this story, and then I'm gonna get into what I've learned and what I'm doing about it. But I just wanted to make sure that everybody understood, like, this is a big deal when we have a business. If people are watching right now, I've got pictures of the barbecues that we had on Fridays. I mean, it was a freaking blast. All of my friends and family were in this business, it felt like. And then we had every single wild suite for 7 years for all the games, all the concerts. We had President's Club that we would go to every single year. So all these trips, all the charities that we were doing were tied to the business and the thousands of customers that we had and our vendors. And, you know, I got this picture of Stan service. We had hunting and fishing trips. It was way more than just the money. And so because we felt stuck, we pulled the ripcord and made a drastic decision. What I found out is not only did I go home and I bawled my face off because I was just like, honestly, everything that I had built and worked for 5 years was just, I mean, dismantled for an exchange of a dollar amount. And I found out that my dad actually went and sat in the parking lot. The 8-figure wire was supposed to hit on 2 o'clock, and it didn't. There was some time zone issues. So for an hour, he freaked out and was crying as well because he thought, he was like, oh my God, what did I do? Well, the bank hit on at 3 o'clock, but it was 8 figures, but we paid a bunch of debt and taxes off. So I want to, that's what my whole mission is. Like, how do we understand all this stuff so we can actually engineer and design the independence that we want? So over the last 10 years, what I did is I went on a mission to figure out how the 25% that Bo talks about, how did they become happy? How did they know who they were, what they wanted from the business, and why? Having 3 out of 4 people end up like Corey and I, my dad and I, is unacceptable, especially when we are the value creators in this country. We take something that is like, literally we grow something from nothing and grow cash flow and grow value. And we should have the ability to have the independence to design the life that we want. And so, okay, now what I'm going to do is talk about the last 10 years and then how that led to the independence by design ownership framework and what is included in that. So we have all this context for all the podcasts that I'm going to be doing. I've got workshops that I do. I've got ownership coaching that I do. And it's just about how do we think about this so that way we can make the right decisions. So, okay, what I do over the last 10 years, read Bo's book, Wrong Order, is what I say. Don't read that book after you've sold and exchanged your whole identity and all the equity for a bank wire, and you're not sure you should have done that. You're gonna hopefully hear over and over and over again, this is not about exiting, but it's about understanding the true value of your company as an owner from the cash flow. What are the trade-offs between cash flow and equity growth, and how do you build the life that you want? After I read that book, well, essentially I lasted 60 days at the buyer's place. And by the way, everybody went to Loeffler. They're a wonderful group of people. I got all the tenure notifications of all of our old employees still working there. And I'm so happy. I'm so happy that everybody's happy. It was not what I wanted, but like everybody else that made it there is happy. And I'm just really happy that we found a good home for the people that ended up going over there. But I lasted 60 days. I walked out of an L10. And I was like, I'm professionally unemployable. I can't be told what to do. And I started in personal wealth management. So I got my Series 65. And I learned a bunch about money. Like I didn't understand anything besides revenue at that point, but this is where the intersection of private equity and finance. I was like, oh my God, really my desire to understand how the world and the economy worked, because massive anxiety, where like someone would be like, Ryan, what do you think about the economy? And you're supposed to be like, it's like, well, and by the way, I lasted about 18 months doing that. I ended up bringing in quite a bit of money with this small fiduciary RIA firm. And it wasn't for me, because I realized that like most people in that industry, I mean, there's some really good people that are wealth managers, don't get me wrong, but a lot of people are sitting there and they make money after someone has made the money. It's just like, that doesn't go help the problem. Like we want to go help the problem of create value. And so while I was doing that a little bit, I'm trying to think, it was like maybe during the transition, I started this podcast, which used to be called Life After Business. Then I rebranded it to Intentional Growth. And now we're on the third iteration of it. But I created this podcast where I just wanted to understand what the hell everybody had done that was happy, right? So I started interviewing people that have bought and grown and sold companies, trying to figure out, okay, who were the happy ones? What did they do? So hundreds of people from crazy success stories, like Norm Bradsky and Sonny Vanderbeck. I mean, oh my God, I got Brent Beshore. Anyways, I'm going to continue walking through some of the people. And all those, by the way, the archive of those are on my personal YouTube channel that is in the show notes below. I also got the exit planning certification. And I'm going to talk about why I don't even like the words exit planning. I don't even know what they are. And I'm going to talk about why that is. But what happened was after that, then I ended up getting into I started this growth and exit planning collaborative where I partnered up with advisors and I had partnered up with an M&A attorney and another finance wealth manager. And the goal was to try and build a team of advisors for owners, do valuations, build a due diligence library, do a value growth assessment to figure out what they can do. And then we were charging 30 to 40 grand for that. That wasn't scalable. And it was miserable for myself because I would have to sell it and then do a lot of the offer, the service. And then it landed right back to like people already knew what they wanted to do, but they just didn't know how to get there. So I was doing that for a while. Then I kept interviewing more and more people on the podcast, focusing more about the technical stuff, from valuations to ESOPs to private equity to investment banking, and as well as operations. I had Gina Wickman on the podcast talking about EOS and how do we align this technical stuff with the operations. And then what happened was I interviewed John Warlow, built the cell. He's got the Value Builder System. He's been on the podcast a couple times. I also got his certification, a lot of different thoughts about that system. And then also Jack Stack, The Great Game of Business, really hearing him talk about the numbers are the game. Like, we have this game, and that's why I like this ownership framework. It's like we have to take what we want, and then the numbers become the data. Jack's been he's been a great guest. Mike McCallow is from Profit First. And then in 2009, I started Arcona with Pat Hobby. Pat and I had this crazy love for helping owner operators who have grown the value to harvest the value and to get what they wanted. Pat and I started the business in doing 2-day workshops where we create a lot of this curriculum, helping business owners understand the valuation, the finances, the exits, so we can give them more information. I think we did it for 7 months, and then that was an in-person training, and then COVID decimated that business. I remember sitting March 13th, 2020, I looked at Pat, I'm like, I think we're effed. We went back, we recorded the first version of the Academy, and we digitized it. But what we had to do is we had to plug the cash flow gap. We had to start doing some other services, which led us to the financials. And then Pat, what he decided, because he was like literally, he's one of the most brilliant CFOs I've ever met. He's a savant, truly. And he took on some clients to help him and I while we were continuing to scale. And that grew fast because out of this big idea, this big problem of how do we grow cash flow and equity while also having more independence, there's a lot of stuff people need. And the financials become one of the first things that people could actually like truly move the needle on. So ended up growing that pretty fast. And then ended up bringing in a couple partners and then modifying that business over time after we bought Pat out. And then we ended up having this financial dashboard offering with two other partners of mine. And I ended up continuing to speak at EO and Vistage. And I ended up realizing that that business and Arcona ended up taking off and helping quite a few people. And I'm pretty proud of what the team had done. And I just was not, I'm not the services guy. Like, I realized over over the last 10 years, I love to speak and I love to create content. And I kept, through EO Vistage, this other company called CEO Nexus, that's got a peer group of a couple hundred owners in there. I love to learn and I want to understand how to help people understand their actions today and how they're going to make more independence through time and through money. And there's a lot of different things people need to do. I started getting ITR Economics and Butcher Joseph on the podcast every 90 days talking about economics and money and valuations and deal structures, because that's all stuff that we need in order to get us where we want to go. So as I'm about done with this, I'm going to start talking about what I learned and how I packaged this all up finally. This all led to Independence by Design. A couple things that I learned. I love turning around big businesses. I mean, that's what I did with the family and our family business, Imaging Path. But then over the last 10 years, the three different companies I've had, bootstrapping through cash flow is rough. And there's always this trade-off of income today versus wealth tomorrow while also doing the job that we love. And those are the dynamics I want to help other people with, which is every day we've got decisions to do. How do we want to spend our time? How do we want to generate more cash flow and equity for the long term? And what are the trade-offs of all that? And so what I learned over this last, 15 plus years is that most business owner operators started or bought their company to create independence. My dad was a copier sales guy, and he didn't do it because he loved copiers. He did it because he was able to make a bunch of money, and he was he didn't graduate college. I mean, he had 90 days in college. And same thing with me. I remember sitting in traffic on the way into work going, I don't want to be sitting in a freaking suit and stuck in traffic where someone is telling me what to do. So everybody I've worked with, a couple thousand people, it's like, I want independence. But then what happens is we get sucked up into the day-to-day of cash flow juggling, hiring people, succession planning, funding, investing, inventory, L10s, mergers and acquisitions, employee comp plans, ERP systems, SEO. It's like, and what happens is That's not why people started their business. They started for independence. And what happens is this leads to an emotional roller coaster where someone's like, I'm excited. This is hard. It's working. I messed up. Give up the good for the great. I think I'm going bankrupt. I'm good. I know. I don't know myself. I don't want to get so down on myself. I was wrong. I suck. Wait a second. This is wonderful. And I killed it. I mean, if people have ever seen that entrepreneur roller coaster, and then what happens is that can happen in 1 minute or like one day, depending on your emails. And the ones who sold and have regrets, they pulled the ripcord and they wanted to get out of that feeling of being stuck and trapped, that emotional gut ache. I don't know if you resonate with that, but like, I don't like being trapped. And I think a lot of people that I work with, like, that's like no thank you. And I'm willing to do ridiculous shit to get out of that feeling. And one of the guys I'm going to interview that's going to be part of this launch, Eric Roman, he talks about, like, I mean, he was cash poor and balance sheet rich. He talks about that. I mean, he scaled and sold up a bunch of dental practices, but this feeling, and that's why 3 out of 4 people regret it. Well, what did the 1 out of 4 people do that were happy? What did I find out? And is the happy people had a decision-making framework and knew exactly how each choice impacted their independence of time, money, and what they wanted from their business. It's this trade-off to say, okay, if this is what I want for my time, how much cash flow and how much equity do I have and what do I need? And how does my decision impact that in the business that I built? And by understanding that context, people can navigate through all those choices and say, oh, this is exactly what I want. They engineer their outcome and it's like a non-event. And so what we've been missing, I believe, as owner-operators, we have operating systems like EOS and all that stuff, but we've been missing an ownership framework. And so I named it the Independence by Design ownership framework, because I believe that that ownership framework, as you can see, it's not about the damn exit. It's about growing cash flow and equities so we can have the independence over our time and do whatever we want to get that independence that we originally wanted when, you know, Michael Gerber calls it the E-myth entrepreneurial seizure. Like, we don't do this to be more in more L10s. It's to have freedom. And so there are 3 steps that the Independence by Design framework has. And I'm going to give a quick overview of each of these and some of the subcategories, because in my YouTube channel, I'm going to be diving a lot more into videos. I'm going to be doing a lot of videos with guests. All of my guests are going to be on video, but also I'm going to continue to do a bunch of training that I whiteboard training. I've got a bunch of ownership coaching that I'm doing and the ownership accelerator and all the stuff. I just want to help with content. And then if people want to join a coaching program with me or individually or the group one, have at it. But like, I want to provide as much of this stuff for free as possible so you can get where you want to go. And so as I play around with the playlists on YouTube, but also on the website, I'm going to be categorizing everything under these 3 different steps of understand the game, choose the game, and then 3rd is play the game. And so there are all of the topics that I've covered for the last 8 years or so. I remember I would do the 2-day boot camps or I do the podcast. And here's what effectively, what I thought people were saying is like, wow, Ryan's really smart and he's really passionate, but I have no idea what the hell to do with any of this shit. It's like, okay, so I went up there and I just, you know, spewed all the stuff that I learned, but there was no, like, what are we supposed to do with all this stuff? Like, how do all these topics tie together? And so I want to make this easy to consume so that way you know if you have a topic that you need to know more about, you can go find it and then you say, okay, well, this is how it impacts what I'm doing as an owner and where I'm trying to go. And the ownership framework should hover right on top of the operating framework, because ownership goals need to drive operations. Private equity doesn't get into a room after they buy a company and say, what should we do, everybody? No, they're like, here's the deal. Here's what we're doing. Here's how much money you got, and here's where we're going. And so there are different levels of clarity on ownership structures, but we have to start with 1 is understand the game. So what understand the game means is shift your mindset from operator to owner. We have to shift their mindset from operator to owner. And what does that mean? We have to have an ownership mindset, which is we own assets. And the reason we own assets is because we've created value, we've created cash flow through our labor, and hopefully we're decoupling ourselves from that labor and growing equity. And we have to think about the ownership mindset, but it's really down to the human level, which is as a human being, What do you want to do with your time? And what do you want to do with your money? And then we have assets in this company that we have to be able to engineer and design the company to satisfy our ownership goals. So I will actually be diving a little bit more into the ownership mindset on this specific episode, but I just want to continue going through the rest of the three steps, and then I'll leave us with the ownership mindset, because all the other ones are a lot more technical and they're in the ownership workshop that I do roughly every 90 days. If you want to check that out, it's on the RyanTansman.com podcast or website. So shift your mindset from operator owner, understand the game. We have to have an ownership mindset. And then the second step of understanding the game is mastering the art of valuations. We need to understand how value is created and how it is judged in privately held companies. If we don't do that, we're guessing. We're waking up every day and we're just hoping our activities are growing value. It's absolutely freaking insane. Like, my dad and I had a $20 million business spending hundreds of thousands of dollars just freaking guessing. So like, we need to understand valuation. There are three KPIs that should be focused on a target cash flow valuation, which is normalized EBITDA, the multiple, and debt. We have to increase cash flow, de-risk the cash flow, and pay down debt. And we can all predict that because private equity and ESOPs do that all day long. So those are the two steps of understand the game. So then once we shift our mindset from operator to owner, because we've understood the game, the second step is we have to choose the game. What do I mean by choose the game? Is we have to clarify your ownership goals. Ownership needs to dictate how operations is built and how much money we have to spend. So the first part of choose the game is we have to understand the different types of ownership. So there are six different types of ownership, and I've actually reworded this because this used to be the exit options, but everybody's like, well, I'm not planning on exiting. And I'm like, well, it doesn't matter. Don't you want to grow cash flow and equity? Why do we have to think of, like, so we're shoving that word exit out of the way, and we're saying, what are the different ownership structures? And so there is family transfers. So family offices that want to keep private equity in their business or in their family. So the family transfers. Internal transfers and buyouts. So that is fair market value of partners, managers, or families who are buying the company with cash flow. The third one is ESOPs, employee stock ownership plans. The fourth one is acquisition entrepreneurs. Then the fifth one, and acquisition entrepreneurs, my buddy Walker Diable wrote the book, Buy Them Build. And those are people buying companies with SBA loans, smaller companies, and wealthy individuals. The fifth ownership structure is private equity, a lot of different flavors of it. And then the sixth one is strategic buyers, which are just other companies. So each of these six ownership structures have different mandates of what are their ownership goals for cash flow and equity growth. That's it. That's all that matters between all of those six. So you are either playing one of those games, consciously or unconsciously, and you're either driving cash flow and equity growth, and you're either on the buy side or the sell side. So we're talking about ownership structures because we're choosing the game of ownership that you want to play based on the ownership structure. The second part of this is of choose the game is leverage an ownership advisory team. So leveraging an ownership advisory team is effectively like, as a owner operator, business owner, you have a lot of illiquid assets, my guess, is a lot of potential investments outside of your business, but you have a business that's got cash flow and equity. You probably have buildings and real estate. And so we need to have essentially a family office like team. When I say like, it's just so difficult to find these people, which is why I talk about it a lot. But you have this portfolio that you need to manage, and you need to be figuring out your taxes, your estate planning around your portfolio, and then making decisions around the trade-offs between cash flow today, equity tomorrow, and in what assets, and then how does your business fit into that? So next, what we're going to be doing, so that we have covered understand the game, choose the game, and then the third is play the game. And so play the game is mastering the business ownership game, like as an owner, not more L10s. Like what we need to do in playing the game of ownership is there are two steps, or two subcategories of play the game. First is create a strategic financial roadmap. We can't be guessing anymore. We can't be just looking at our income statement. The only way we get visibility into the future is by creating a three-statement model, which is your income statement, your balance sheet, and your cash flow statement that are mathematically tied together and forecasted into the future. The only way we can see the trade-offs between distributions, taxes, and reinvestment and how that impacts equity growth and cash flow is by having a strategic financial roadmap with your strategies. And that is the fabric and the glue between ownership and then the operations. And then everybody needs to execute that using a system like EOS. So ownership and leadership alignment is the second part of this. And this happens through taking an executive, like a CEO, and we're going to be comping the executive team based on distributions, working capital, and equity growth. And so in this, the launch, I've got someone that's going to be talking about taxes, Roger Roundy. I've got someone that's also going to be talking about executive comp, which is Craig Rutledge. I mean, these are some of the best people I've found that is helping us understand how to engineer this alignment, because this is what ESOPs and private equity do. They're like, okay, well, we now have to grow the shareholders' value and we have to grow cash flow. And we can't finance our way there and be broke. So we have to have this alignment by creating a three-statement model that says, okay, owner's goals of distributions are 500 grand without having to work. We need to be able to pay our taxes and fund the growth of the company and hit the $10 million equity valuation in 2030. So if you have $1 million in cash flow, you got 300 grand in taxes. Maybe you take, let's say it's 200 grand in distributions. The company's only got 500 grand. So let's take all of the rocks and all the stuff to fund the growth. And we need to fund projects that de-risk the cash flow to grow the valuation of the company, grow that multiple. So grow the cash flow, de-risk the cash flow, and pay down debt. And that's the private equity playbook right there. And we all have that ability to do that, which is grow cash flow, de-risk that cash flow through good strategic projects, and then pay down debt to create and engineer equity value. Okay. Sorry, I'm going through a fire hose. I love this stuff. I'm so passionate about it. And you can put this on slow. You can speed it up. My guess is you don't need it sped up, but I'm zooming back out. And then I'm going to leave us on ownership mindset to really highlight this trade-off between time, money, and equity growth. And then we're going to be, you'll be able to dive into the rest of the podcast episodes. Go to the YouTube channel. You can go to my website. We got the workshops. They're invite only. But if you are able to shoot me an email or something like that, we'll figure out if it makes sense. So here's where we're at. Independence by design ownership framework. Three steps. Understand the game, which is shift your mindset from operator to owner. Two, choose the game. Clarify your ownership goals. Three, play the game, master the business ownership game. And now you're hovering at top, up top while your operations is aligned with your cash flow and equity goals of the company. So what does this mean? And why am I going into the ownership mindset? It's because I'm going to talk more about what is this, what are the goals of time and money and equity and cash flow. So ownership mindset starts with, we have two roles. I have had people over the last decade call me up and be like, Ryan, I want out. And then I'd like roll up my sleeves and try and help them and all that stuff. I'm like, well, you know what? What the hell do they want out of? And then I'd ask people questions and it'd be like, well, employee reviews and supply chain issues and vendor issues. And I'm like, they want out of their job. No one was calling me up and saying, Ryan, I'm really sick and tired of my $500 or $1 million distributions while someone else runs my company. And we have to realize that we have two roles and hats that we have on. Owner and operator. There's a reason there's that hyphen there. And the people listening in and the people that I've worked with generally fit into this owner-operator category. I'm not working with people that are raising money on an idea because it's VC funding. There's a place in the market for that. That's not my gig. But then there's also people who are sitting on the board and they're a family office already. Someone else is running their company. More power to them. It's this category of people who are creating the value because they've got this job. And so the operator part of the owner-operator is a W-2 paycheck. You're getting paid every 2 weeks for time you're spending in that business through your job, and you are tied into operations. But also on the other side of that owner hat, we have to figure out a framework to take that operator hat off, quit talking about the L10s and saying, okay, what are the trade-offs between reinvestments and distributions? That's really it, right? Is Apple going to be reinvesting to build out AI, or are they giving me a dividend? And that is your duty as an owner to say, what are the trade-offs between reinvesting into strategies or taking more money out? That's why the cash flow has to go first. Then what is the equity growth target? What is the value of this asset that I want to have? Because those reinvestments or distributions are going to impact that equity growth. And then what is the exit timeline if we have one. We don't have to have one, but like, what are the ways that we want to monetize this asset and when? And are we constantly looking at the third-party marketplace, which is why I've had Butcher Joseph and ITR on saying like, by the way, the multiples have been asinine over the last 5 years. People are getting 20, 30 times multiples, and they shouldn't be. But that's because you got dumb money chasing few companies, and it might be your time to punch out. But like, we that's the ownership hat. So we have this owner operator. So what we have to do now, and what all I'm trying to solve for, is the ownership framework. There are plenty of systems out there for the operating framework, but I'm assuming that you have a good idea how to run your company. And I'll be talking about different ways to align sales, marketing strategies, and finance and all that stuff to ownership. But effectively, we're thinking about this from like, as if we're private equity, even though you're most likely have a role in the company. So the first question we have to start with is, what are you solving for as a person? What are you solving for? And I start with time, and then I'm going to get to cash flow and equity growth, and then I'm going to be done. So I'm going to hopefully wrap us up here pretty soon. So here's why we start with time. And I have thought a lot about this because Dan Sullivan's got his four freedoms and money's on it. And I respect him for the four freedoms. He's got a lot of good material out there, but money's not the goal. And I can tell you that from hundreds of people I've interviewed, their life is a dumpster fire. Their relationships suck. They got a huge portfolio, the colorful Charles Schwab account with millions or maybe billions of dollars in there, and their life sucks. So it's like, okay, well, when I go back to like when people pull that ripcord and they feel stuck, why was that? It was because they did not have independence over their time, or they were feeling stuck in part of their time allocation. So what I'm looking at here on the screen is there are four components of our time that I think we need to be optimizing for. The first one is people. Who do we want to be interacting with on a day-to-day basis? And why I go back to time is because time is a great equalizer. Everybody listening in here has 168 hours of time. That's it. And we've got an X amount of weeks that we live, and then that's it. So like, time is the biggest resource for each one of us, and we can either waste it or we can save it, but we have to figure out how we're going to use it. So I think finding out who we want to interact with for people is important. And that could be in both your owner and operator hats. Like, this is, I'm talking to the human level here because you have this company and this company is intermingled into this, but like, every day, who are you working with? Like I said, I had all of these people in this, all these things, all these people tied to my business, and it disappeared once the business disappeared. That sucked. But if the people that you're working with you don't like and you want to change that, you might want to do something drastic. So then it's activities. Are you doing the things that you want to do? That like that's your creative, you know, your creative genius, you're the flow zone. And you know, like for me, if it's speaking or podcasting or doing this versus grinding in a spreadsheet or, you know, making sales calls, doing the activities that you want to do. And then the third one is topics. Are you talking about what you want to talk about? I love talking about business and I love talking about this stuff. You couldn't pay me enough money to talk about cost per copy anymore and copiers and duplication and scanning. So people, activities, topics, and the fourth one is purpose. Are you doing something above and beyond yourself that's bigger than yourself? And I say this because all four of these, if they're in balance, I think they're floating through life. I know Gina Wickman and Rob Dubay talk about this floating through life. And like, I think people can do that if they're working with the people they want to work or interacting with the people they want to interact with, doing the things that they want to do, talking about the things that they want to talk about on a purpose that's beyond themselves. When one of these is off, then people feel stuck and trapped and they want to hit that ripcord and get out. So hopefully that was a good explanation, because I really want you to think about, how do you want to be spending your time? Because the independence over time is what it's all about. Money is supposed to buy us independence over our time. And so it's not the goal though. And so cash flow that's not tied to our labor is the goal. And then we get that through and store that in equity and assets that store our value. So money creates independence. It's not the goal. And that is the ownership mindset, ownership and financial assets that have cash flow and equity growth. And so our business fits into this, but how does our business fit into this? And I've got a couple more concepts and then I'll be done. Okay. So when I think about goals for the company and how the company fits into this, If we don't understand the valuation game, there's no context for decision-making. And why that is because if I ask someone in the nature of a goal, if I ask someone what their goal is, the goal will drive all of their decisions. It's going to course correct us. We're going to take that goal. We're going to put it under our VTO. We're going to break it down into, you know, 1, 3, and 5 years, and then, you know, 90-day rocks, and then weekly KPIs. And like, okay, great. The goal drives the behavior. If revenue is the goal, now all I've heard over the last 10 years is 25 million in revenue, 10 million in revenue, 100 million in revenue. And it's like, okay, well, if revenue is the goal, that doesn't make any sense to me. And here's why. My father, Corey, and I had a $21 million business that lost $940,000 in 2009. If we would have sold the business, we would have owed the bank $2.5 million. Who cares? We could have told everybody, and I think we did. We hit the Inc. 5000 and Fastest 50, and we were best places to work. And like, who cares? Who gives a shit? We literally have negative equity and owed the bank money if everything was tied to revenue. And if revenue is the goal, how are we making decisions on new product or service? Should we launch managed IT services or software automation? Or should you, like, I mean, should you step back from the day-to-day and hire a CEO or CFO? Should you sell the company? I don't know. Should you buy a company? Who knows? I mean, like, all those decisions don't make any sense. They don't reconcile against the goal that as the right goal. So if we shift our mindset and we say, okay, what is the target equity valuation at a point in time, regardless if we want to freaking sell or not? What is the target equity valuation and value that we want to create? And equity is really important. I'll be talking a lot about that throughout the podcast. And what is the income that we need? So if we need $250,000 in distributions above and beyond our salary, and we want a valuation of $10 million in 2030, how do we fund that growth plan while taking our distributions? Everything becomes visible for the decisions of new product or service. Step back from the day-to-day, buy a company, sell a company. If it gets you to your goal on time, if it gets you there faster, larger valuation, or you have more freedom, like, otherwise don't do it. Take the money home. Because like, there are so many times where it's like, hey, you're growing so fast, but you have no cash. Maybe if you slowed down your growth and you had more cash, then you could hire someone and you could go back and do whatever you wanted. Like, what the hell are we solving for? If it's independence over time, we need to get the cash flow first through distributions. And then we got to figure out how that impacts our timeline and our ability to fund the equity growth. These are just the levers that become visible to say, okay, how do we do this? And what are the trade-offs? And in the target equity valuation, those are the three KPIs, the private equity playbook, which is normalized EBITDA, the multiple, and debt. How do we increase the cash flow, de-risk the cash flow, and pay down debt on the way there? But we have to make sure that we start with income. And the reason I start with income, and then I'll tie into the equity, and then I'll be done. Because this hopefully gives a solid framework for the rest of the podcast and for my coaching, why to potentially go to a workshop, you name it, or just go do this yourself and hopefully have the right goals. So the first three income targets, why do we start with the income targets? Well, because if you're not making any money, hopefully you're creating an asset. And I read this article in MSNBC a couple years ago, 26.2% of privately held businesses don't pay themselves a salary. I hope to God you're making a valuable asset. Otherwise, go work for 3M and get a pension. Like, it's just a hope. So we have to get market wage. So that's base case. The second income target is salary plus distributions. Hopefully you're starting to make some distributions on top of your salary to get that ownership. And then the three is distributions. And if we can make income through distributions, game one. So here's what this looks like in a graph. And I've spent a lot of time thinking about this graph over the last 10 years. So the first one is salary. So right here, we've got operator, where we got cash flow coming from our time. We are trading time for cash flow that's coming in the form of a salary, and then it's driving our net worth. So if you're listening in, this picture right here has got a business as part of the pie chart, real estate and investment. So this net worth, we have to be growing through our salary first as in the operator. And you say, okay, well, the business there, like we're growing the value of the business, but I also got outside real estate and investments. Okay, so then what's the next step? Well, the next step, hopefully, we start taking some distributions on top of our salary. So now if you look over here on the visual, we've got operator from cash flow and owner. So now we're taking some cash flow from ownership. And then I've got this ability to see we're taking that salary, but that's going down over time while we're increasing our distributions. And that should be funding the net worth that we have as a target. And then the third step is income through just distributions. So if you can maintain $250,000 in cash flow through distributions while someone else runs your company, game one, especially if the company's worth whatever you need it to be worth if you were to sell it. If not, keep it. Like, true choices. And this right here is what I see is all of my clients right now, or most of the people I've worked with over the years, if they can passively maintain their income through distributions while someone else is running their company as the integrator, doing the L10s, doing all that stuff, this is what private equity does. It's like, hey, I got an asset kicking out cash while I'm free to do what I want with my time. If you want to be the sales manager or the designer or the CMO or the podcaster, that's your choice. But if you wake up one day and you're sitting there on a Sunday and you're looking at your calendar, you're going, damn it, I don't want to do this stuff this week that I'm obligated to do. You don't have to. That's independence to me. And you can do that because if you're making 20, 50 grand a month, whatever it is per month in distributions, while someone else runs your company, you can do that. So this is what this looks like in total of the game of ownership mindset. And then I'm about done. Okay, so we got cash flow over here. If our goal is to maintain cash flow of $250,000, we want to shift that from salary down to, we want to decrease that salary, increase it, increase the distribution. So that 250 is coming from distributions. Well, what do we need our net worth to be while we own the company without selling it? Let's say we got $1 million in real estate and $1 million in investments that could kick out some cash. We would have to net $3 million after debt and taxes to maintain that cash flow without touching the principal. That's roughly in the 4 or 5% withdrawal without touching your principal. A lot of assumptions, but my point is we've got a framework to say, well, now what the hell is the company worth? And that's what I'm going to talk a lot about over these, in my YouTube channel, but also in the trainings and the workshop is like, we can measure and monitor the value of the company while we own it with the three-statement financial model. And whoever does it, I don't care if your CFO does it, you got a software to do it, or like you got a template, I don't give a shit. As long as you know that the only way to get this visibility is through a three-statement forecast. And I didn't make any of this stuff up. Pat Hobby and I always joked around, it's double entry accounting was invented in the 1400s by the monks, and the Bill Gates and Paul Allen either stole the spreadsheet or invented in the 80s. It's math and a spreadsheet. And so we can get this visibility to say, okay, when can I get my distributions without having to work? And so I've been working with Tracy back from the 60 Minute CFO. She's got a fantastic book and she's been building out an ownership template for my people that are going to the Independence by Design Owners Workshop, as well as the Ownership Accelerator. So people can get the back of the napkin math saying, okay, what does my income statement and balance sheet need to look like? So that way I can maintain my distributions, my income through distributions while I'm paying a CEO the right comp plan and making sure they're comped on working capital and normalized EBITDA growth and multiple growth. And so as I wrap up here is, here's the game. Here's the ownership mindset and what independence by design means, which is, what do we want out of our time? I'm sorry, I don't think most people just can't wait to do more work. If that's your passion, that's your choice. But I want it to be your choice. So are you working with the people you want to work with, doing the activities that you love on the topics that you enjoy on a purpose beyond yourself with your time? How does that company as a vehicle provide us the ability to do that? What's our desired income if it's 250 through distributions? What's the valuation, equity valuation we want at a point in time? And then what's backend and build the financial roadmap to see the trade-offs between reinvestment, distributions, and taxes, and then have your operations implement all that using a system like EOS so you can essentially go on track, off track. So I believe that this framework is what everybody that I've worked with is looking for. And I'll tell you what, if I would have had this, Corey and I'd either have a $100 million business, but I'll back up and I'll finish with what I would have done differently. I know that my dad just wanted income and he didn't want to talk about copies anymore. We were reinvesting too much money into the business, building managed IT services because I thought it was awesome, but it might have had to slow down. If Corey would have been able to maintain his income, we probably could have had that different conversations with the bank. And then if we would have had a three-statement model, I know that I could have made the salary that I wanted to while growing cash flow and equity growth. And he could have logged in once a month and said, hey, Ryan, how's working capital? Do I get my $40,000 in distributions each month? How's the equity growth going? We could have done a partial buyout where I could have gone and got some bank funding to buy him some and get him some liquidity. We could have done a partial ESOP. We could have done a partial private equity sale, or I could have bought it through a seller financing because I grew the cash flow and I was able to use the cash flow that I grew it with to buy him out. I didn't know how to even say any of that stuff. And we would have had all these options, but we had no idea. We pulled the ripcord, just like Eric Roman, who's going to be talking about it on the podcast. And so my goal with the Independence by Design ownership framework is to help you understand how to get unstuck from the day-to-day by thinking about the cash flow, the trade-offs between cash flow now, equity growth tomorrow, and then how to direct those resources into your business so you can create and design the independence that you want so you can do what you want with your time. Because I think time is the ultimate independence. I mean, so many people today are doing things they don't want to do because they are striving for more cash flow and equity growth. And in the next episode I talk about with Joe Brown is like, there's a whole nother layer of complexities on this as the economic machine is very dysfunctional. And I think we have the opportunity as owner operators to use our companies as a cash flowing machine to preserve wealth and to grow our wealth into other things while delinking our time. Like if we can have someone else run the business and we've got the right metrics in place and we understand what we're measuring and monitoring for that person, and we don't have to have our time linked to the cash flow, then we have more choices and we can truly be capital allocators with our business and really sit on that capital heap to say, okay, what are the best places to allocate your capital and your cash flow? So, if anybody's still listening in, I'll tell you what, I can do this for days. I hope that this was helpful. I am so curious to hear if people listen to this on one time, or maybe it was 0.7 and you're usually a 1.5 speed person, but there's a lot of fun episodes to come from tax mitigation with Roger Roundy. I can't even believe I hadn't met him until recently. Joe Brown talking about the economic machine and money. I've got Craig Rutledge talking about executive compensation and tying it into all this stuff that we're talking about. Tracy Beck, the 60-minute CFO. I've got her coming on the podcast talking about the three statement models. Mike Vermelt talking about key executive search. I've got valuation, Brandon Hall from SB. He does over 100 valuations a year. And my goal is that all these topics and guests that I'm bringing on, they're going to continue to layer in more and more context to this big picture. And the people that are a part of my owner, the Independence by Design Ownership Accelerator that comes with weekly calls, I'm bringing in these guests into the back boardroom so we can have some really intense Q&A breakouts with these people. So my goal is to get you where you want to go faster and shortcut the hard stuff that I've done. So even if you're an avid listener on this podcast, send it to friends that you think would appreciate this. Subscribe on all the main podcast players. If you could give me a review, that would be unbelievably amazing. I'd be very grateful. Subscribe on YouTube. And I just want to thank everybody. And I'm very excited for this next stage of the journey. Have a great day.